I suppose the map of Alexander the Great's quartered Greek Empire, page 218, might mean a little bit more to you by now. We know the origin of the Antichrist cannot come from Egypt, the green area, and that he must come from one of the other three of these kingdoms, the pink, gold, or gray areas. Still, there seems to be a strong connection to the Seleucid kingdom, the gray one. But how can we be sure whether he simply comes from one of these kingdoms and establishes his empire elsewhere, or does both in one of them? But we do know that neither of these scenarios can change the fact that he will end up in Israel at the midpoint either way. Having gone this far through Daniel 11, we can see that God focuses a lot of his attention in this prophecy on the conflicts between the Ptolemaic and Seleucid kingdoms in the six Syrian wars. And there are a lot of people pulling for the Antichrist and his kingdom being established in this region of the former Seleucid kingdom, also home of the former Babylonian and Medo-Persian empires. But we have really seen nothing conclusively in favor of this case. And we have already seen that, geographically, there is a strong case against it. But there are a couple more references that seem to support it that we'll eventually get to. And the resolution of all this must involve all these details and more. The strongest case must be made without any visible contradiction or compartmentalization. And when we're done, we'll be able to confirm that the Antichrist will establish his kingdom in a region mostly missing from this map. So since we've come all this way to identify more attributes of the Antichrist and his kingdom, let's get to it. And the richest source of essential information about the Antichrist, now that we're ready to understand it, is in the remainder of Daniel 11, starting in verse 21. Still, I should re-emphasize about now that this is a newly discovered view of this transition in Daniel's prophecy, at least for me. It's also appropriate to make clear that for these last about 20 years, since the day star dawned in my heart, I remained mostly lost in this chapter. But I remember wanting to know who this guy in verse 20 was from the very beginning. And I asked repeatedly over the years. I tried to find possibilities in his time zone, but I had nothing that I thought really fit. And it's hard to identify anyone in this chapter when distracted with trying to figure out who everyone else is. I ruled out Augustus as a possibility for this verse early on, while at the same time trying to squeeze him into some of the others. So this guy in verse 20 was always messing things up. But then again, it all kept coming back to this one guy. And one day not long ago, everyone else fell into place. And when they did, and when I could see that the age of grace was part of the equation, I could finally see how the guy I had long ago ruled out really was a perfect fit. And I believe this was all God's doing and timing. But again, most of the understanding in the first 20 verses of this chapter is new to at least me. And this figurative, as opposed to literal, concealed presentation of Augustus, that hid who he was by his connection to the start of the Age of Grace, is the revelation that God showed me most recently. And it's funny, because God showed me very early on that I was supposed to be careful about figurative versus literal interpretations. On the other hand, early on, I could tell that everyone else I was aware of, and I have listened to lots of teachers of prophecy, were at least as lost as I was in this chapter, and as far as I know, still are. The point is that these new revelations must be refinable over time, which is and should be the case with all new revelations. But it's also fair to say that I have waited in patience and faith for a long time for this, and that the time for it has come. All these considerations make me confident that we have something new here from God that is at least worth continuing to prove. But I am also confident because most of what's left in chapters 11 and 12 has been already long ago revealed to me by my teachers. And because I believed God would finish opening this prophecy for us eventually, as if waiting was a choice. But I misunderstood something else until very recently. I thought that the time of the end had already fully come, because I understood most of Daniel's prophecies, except for this annoying little, okay, huge, section in Daniel 11. Somehow I overlooked the fact that Gabriel's instruction to Daniel, that he shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end, applied just as much to Daniel 11 as 12, and not really so much to the rest of his prophecies. And teachers aren't allowed to use the excuse that other teachers were overlooking this too. So I believe that it was the time of the end, even though no one I knew could anywhere near fully understand this chapter, though too many acted as if they could. I mean, an embarrassing number were going along with Mr. Pompous Ass, however ignorantly, and unfortunately still are. But in fact, one of the characteristics of a living faith should be that you are in a perpetual process of waiting on God for answers that he hasn't given to you yet. My ongoing relationship with God proves to me again and again he will eventually answer me. Sometimes he's very fast, like when he answers so fast it occurs to me he must have known what I was going to ask beforehand. But also in my experience, sometimes he takes decades or more. And I'm still waiting on some of my decades-old questions, too. But not on nearly as many as I used to be, though there are no shortage of new ones. So by faith it is my testimony before God that this prophecy is now open, meaning that the time of the end has now finally fully come, which I see as a great revelation indeed. And I mean that God has shown me the rightly divided interpretation, or the prophecy is still at least somewhat closed. But don't get excited. That doesn't mean I think the rapture of the church could happen any moment. Actually, I will continue making the case that it's still going to be a while, at least from our perspective anyway. Some of the proof of this will be coming directly from Scripture, and some by watching scripturally indicated current events. Luke 12:37, 21:34-36, Matthew 24:42-44, 25:13, Mark 13:33-37, 1 Peter 4:7, Acts 20:28-31, and Revelation 3:3. But I can't say often enough that the better proof of all this is in the entire interpretation of this prophecy altogether, which we are still in the process of. And that even better is the entire study and beyond. Moving on then, we can next notice that from this point to the end of the chapter, the apparent complete lack of character changes in the person of the King of the North becomes the best clues to help us decipher what is happening. And this must be discerned from the descriptions of the events themselves that we will see naturally support this conclusion because of what we already know about the Antichrist. And this is how we will at the same time identify additional heretofore unknown attributes of his. But again, everyone already recognizes him in verse 36 on. He has been made famous by these verses. But you should prepare yourself to learn a lot more about the Antichrist's behavior in the Great Tribulation than you've heard before. That is, if you think you're mature enough for it. So the first thing we should notice in verse 21 is that we're dealing with a new King of the North. Remember, there's reason to believe that it's no accident that the terms king or kingdom are not used in verses 16 through 19, because it's during the days of the Caesarless Roman Republic. And Julius would be the next king of the north, because he is referred to in these terms in verse 6, and because he is seen rising to and falling from this position in verses 17 through 19. And we can now see that it's the reign of Caesar Augustus that follows in verse 20, specifically referred to as over a kingdom. And the authority he attains over his kingdom implies that he is the next king of the north. And it's certainly a new character introduced in verse 21 that will obtain the kingdom. And he appears to be the same character who is specifically called the king of the north in verse 40, who everyone identifies as the Antichrist. So again, it is appearances, that there appear to be no more character changes in the king of the north from here on, which is our first clue that we should at least suspect that the Antichrist first appears in verse 21. I mean, besides that the age of grace is hidden in verse 20. But this alone is not conclusive, especially because there have been so many character changes in the king of the north in previous verses, seen only by the events and without much other notice. So this will require us to understand all the future events too, at least to a certain extent. But we do know that the entire 7-year Antichrist kingdom will have just one supreme king, and that this king's reign begins when he gains control of 10 others. We also know he dies and is resurrected along the way. And because of what we now know about the preceding 16-verse description of the rise and fall of the entirely unhidden Greek Empire, we should at least guess that the arguably most important Antichrist kingdom, that should also be entirely unhidden, should get the most detailed description of all, if it all fits. And it does. Double meaning intended as usual. I mean, I see by far the identifiably longest description in this chapter to be about the Antichrist and his kingdom, starting in verse 21. I see the initial covenant, and the takeover, and the rise to power of the Antichrist over his kingdom. I see the beginning of Sorrow's armed conflict, and the negotiations with Egypt. I even see the world powers in conflict with the Antichrist that at one point force his retreat. I also see the Antichrist's devices against Israel that lead to the abomination of desolation. Beyond this, I see the ones who are persecuted, suffering and dying for their faith in Christ, much like we have already seen portrayed by John in his vision, and by Jesus in his end times discourse on the Mount of Olives. And I see all this and more before verse 36, where the Antichrist is more popularly believed to appear, at least to those who are like I used to be, lost in Daniel 11. We are also navigating on a course that assumes that whoever stands up in verse 21 shall stand up in Caesar Augustus's estate, or in his place, or in his station. So we are no longer seeing this king of the north as Persian, or in the line of the Greek Seleucid dynasty. And we understand that those who do are way off course. Yes, we started in the 3rd year of Cyrus the Persian, but the kings of the north have changed from Persian to Greek to Roman, while the kings of the south have all been Greeks in Egypt. So if indeed this king of the north in verse 20 is Augustus, and if the vile person in verse 21 that in his estate shall stand up is the Antichrist, then the estate of the Antichrist here is the former Roman Empire, certainly not the Medo-Persian or any other part of the Greek Empire. And this need not conflict with the fact that he, the Antichrist, must come out of, in one way or another, one of the divisions of the Greek Empire. And all this seems to be a clue that, though he may come out of one of these three Greek kingdoms, Egypt being already excluded, his estate appears to be Augustus's Roman Empire. And the estate of Rome under Augustus is quite vast, covering most all of Satan's former kingdoms, and much more throughout Europe and North Africa, except, because of those pesky Parthians, most of Persia. So, bringing with us our expectation from chapter 8 that this new king of the north is a king somehow coming out of one of the four notable kingdoms of Alexander the Great's quartered empire, we now add a new perspective from Daniel 11 that he establishes himself in the same kingdom of the estate of Caesar Augustus. And this implies that only the former kingdoms of Cassander, pink, and Lysimachus, gold, can be considered eligible regions that fall fully within Augustus's estate. I mean, if the Antichrist is to originate and rise in the same country, both in one of Alexander's kingdoms and also fully within Augustus's estate, it looks like we're talking about someone from present-day Greece, Macedonia, or Bulgaria. But the coastal regions of Lysimachus's kingdom in present-day Turkey, which were also in Augustus's realm, shared the rest of present-day Turkey with the former Seleucid kingdom, a region not controlled by Augustus. Again, it's the Parthians that hold most of the former Seleucid kingdom, including a good part of present-day Turkey, during Augustus's reign. In this perspective, Lysimachus's kingdom is a more debatable candidate for the origin of the Antichrist kingdom because it implies the splitting of Turkey again. Still, you could say that these choices all more or less fit everything, except, if you've been watching, that a world-ruling 10-nation confederacy doesn't pop right out at you that could arise from any of these nations. But if the Antichrist's estate is established in Augustus's estate, but he himself does not originate within that region, then he could very well originate anywhere in Persia. And certainly we will see that he must rise to power in one of 10 European countries, not necessarily including Greece, Macedonia, or Bulgaria. And that an original estate in Persia, including Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran, etc., is out of the question. And I mean that we will prove that the Antichrist must come out of Persia, but will establish his kingdom first in Europe. But many nowadays are predicting the fall of westernized Europe because of the growing Muslim factions within, and of the United States too. But prophecy does not predict this. It will not be so. But again, Muslim extremists, with the help of the Muslim moderates who fear them, will cause lots more trouble in Southwest Asia, Europe, North Africa, America, and beyond. But original Europeans will eventually rise and rally around their strongest cultural bond, which is their shared religious culture. This same religious culture is going to be the real mover and shaker in the Americas, too. And the Antichrist will be behind it all. This we will prove, too, which we are already in the process of doing. Our understanding so far tells us that the Antichrist, appearing in one of the three eligible Greek dynasties, is repeatedly transplanted, probably settling in locations all over Europe, but ultimately in Israel. And all this fits with current events, most of which we will come to understand that Gabriel predicts right here in the remainder of chapter 11. And don't worry that you don't see all this yet. Top evangelical teachers of prophecy don't either. But repeated review of the parts that you're not sure you understood is always in order. So we're looking for the Antichrist, either him or the successor of Augustus, Tiberius Caesar. In the next, vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably, and obtain the kingdom by flatteries, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Verses 21 and 22. I see these two verses doing a similar job as verses 5 and 6. They give a summary that will be followed up with layered detail. And the first thing we learn is to be expected. The Antichrist is popularly believed to be revealed when he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. Daniel 9:27. He is the ultimate negotiator, as well as the ultimate flatterer, so that by peaceful negotiations and some later confirmed dishonorable and deceitful political maneuvering, he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. This must be when he shall obtain the first of the 10 kingdoms that he will use to uproot 3 and thereby gain control of them all. This uprooting must be what we see in verse 22, where Gabriel records, "And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken." This flood must be a metaphor for a swift and powerful army in action. And this implies that he initially peacefully commandeers the army of just one kingdom, and with it shortly thereafter violently overcomes 3, or possibly 3 more, with which he forces the issue with the remainder. These are the 3 kings he shall subdue from Daniel 7:24. And logically, since also the Prince of the Covenant is overflown and broken in this blitzkrieg, I don't take it that Gabriel is talking about Jesus. I instead take it to mean that the original king he outmaneuvers also becomes a casualty of this flood. And I also take it to mean that this same first king, into whose kingdom the Antichrist shall come in peaceably, will also be the key player along with the Antichrist in establishing the 7-year covenant with many that the Antichrist confirms. Daniel 9:27. So again, this violent overthrow of 3 kings must include the original Prince of the Covenant, who is involved with, and most responsible for, helping to reveal the mystery of iniquity, the Antichrist, by the far-reaching peace treaty they evidently broker together. And apparently we also see here that the signing of this treaty is pretty much the signing of the death warrant of the Prince of the Covenant. It will be his undoing, and also apparently starts the clock on the Great Tribulation. Verse 23 elaborates upon this story that begins in verse 21 and 22 with more detail, restarting again with the Antichrist's peaceful entrance into the first of the 10 kingdoms. Right away, we can see a similar pattern to how Gabriel unfolds the story of the Greek Empire. And we know that for the Roman Empire, there simply wasn't enough exposable detail, along with a plan to avoid calling much attention to this limited detail, to see much of a pattern at all in the descriptions of that kingdom. And this is how we can see that the descriptions of Rome are more or less hidden in and merged into the descriptions of the Greek and Antichrist kingdoms. But there is clearly a pattern restart here that helps those of us with New Testament hindsight to see that a new story of a new kingdom is beginning. The fact that the Antichrist will usurp authority peaceably is established elsewhere by Gabriel. In chapter 8, he explains to Daniel that the Antichrist, by peace, shall destroy many. Daniel 8:25. In chapter 11, verse 23, he adds that, after the league, or peace treaty, made with him, he shall work deceitfully. For he shall come up, and shall become strong with a small people." So here we have an elaboration on how he gets his foot in the door with a small people through his league or covenant with a number of nations, a treaty possibly involving many more nations than the 10 he'll take over. We also see here that he'll deceitfully use it to leverage control of the 10. Seems clear enough. By the way, up to this point, there should be some uncertainty as whether the league or the uprooting comes first. The confirmation that the league or the covenant must come first is finally seen in this verse. I mean, maybe you thought that since the covenant itself is defined to be for 7 years, that it must in turn define the Great Tribulation, and therefore must be the only event that can mark the mystery of iniquity. This is the popular version that we have all been led to believe anyway. Well, there is more evidence for that conclusion now, because we can confirm here that the Antichrist must uproot 3 kings after the league by working deceitfully. This also goes with the idea that the flatteries that allow the Antichrist to obtain the kingdom from the Prince of the Covenant must happen during the negotiations of the league. But more importantly, this is another reminder to be careful about what you think is proven about things that haven't happened yet. Because in spite of everything, we should be expecting that things will actually go down in a way we did not really fully foresee. I mean, it's still the unrevealed mystery of iniquity after all, isn't it? And by the way, the rapture must come just before the mystery of iniquity is revealed, so it could be considered a marker of it too, a marker that must precede it. And we will see other markers that must precede it before we're done. And one more thing. It's obvious that none of this account from verse 20 on fits Tiberius Caesar at all. So next, we must be seeing the Antichrist settling into his newly won kingdom. Gabriel says, "He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey, and spoil, and riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time." Verse 24. If a time times and a half is 3.5 years, then a time may very likely be about 1 year. And we can assume here that we are talking about the Antichrist's focus in the first year of his kingdom, which is the first year of the beginning of sorrows. And the unconventional approach spoken of here is really no mystery either, because it's directly explained as a specific policy that has not gone on for generations. I mean, I expect the presently long-standing operations of modern civil government that will have then been going on since his father's fathers will degenerate to, probably, a more Roman Republic style of operations. I mean, instead of the modern one-man, one-vote, egalitarian democracy that Western Europeans have become used to, we should expect a regression from universal civil rights and liberties to a system where the Antichrist will clearly be seen to ally with one majority group in order to scatter and make prey of all the minority ones. I see him reverting back to a pre-Augustus confiscation method of revenue raising, otherwise known as spoil, but in a way that only victimizes these minority outcast factions. But the implication is that this plot or plan will take time, because the last line of this verse seems to be a summary of this mini-campaign that includes a timetable. Gabriel concludes, "Yea, or to make a long story short, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time." So he will need evidently about a year to defeat, round up, and or eradicate certain of these undesirable factions within his kingdom. This interpretation will receive more support and clarification as we go. But verse 24 is the first example we've come to so far that really begs a question. And the question is, which faction or factions will the Antichrist find desirable? And which ones will he scatter and make prey of and spoil? We've already talked about how I expect the Antichrist will be rounding up and or exterminating Jews and Christians during the beginning of sorrows. This is a no-brainer. I mean, we're talking about the Antichrist here, in his kingdom. He will not do any less to Jews than Hitler did to them. We'll also see it makes sense that he will be rounding up Muslims somewhere along the way too. But who will be doing all this rounding up? In Europe, the strongest dominating cultural faction would be the Catholics. I see them rounding up and or exterminating Jews and Muslims, but also the new Protestants, the old ones having left in the rapture. But aren't Catholics Christians? Yes and no. They certainly haven't always gotten along with Protestants. But that story is told in the next section. So I'm going to ask you at this point just to go along with me for a while on this one until we get through it all, sometime next section. Then you'll at least see my point of view. Of course, I also maintain that it's God's point of view, because Scripture leaves us no other reasonable alternative. And whatever the case, we can already tell here that the Antichrist will use the strongest cultural faction as his ally to gain control, his specific strategy being to bring down the strongholds of the enemy factions, including surely the synagogues of Jews, but likely also the churches of Protestants, and finally the mosques of Muslims. And in order to accomplish all this, he will evidently have to forecast or plot against the strongholds of his enemies for a time. The Jews should be easily enough overcome first because of their small number. And Protestants should also easily enough be overcome next because of the rapture. The Muslims could be a little tougher, and I don't expect the Antichrist's conflict with them to remain entirely inside his borders, as we will see. But I'm sure the Antichrist's strategy will be impeccably effective. Once again, we will strengthen this case as we go. And on this same course, other cases for the rise of the Antichrist kingdom among the Muslim tribes of Southwest Asia, or in the melting pot known as the United States, will, in due course, be rejected. But here we can only tell for sure that the Antichrist will initially, peaceably and deceitfully, and ultimately ruthlessly, come in and spoil part of his own kingdom for the benefit of another part. But this also seems to imply that in order for him to come in, he will first have to come out of someplace else. We should likewise recognize that the beginning of verse 24 implies that the Antichrist changes his original camp in his new kingdom, evidently repeatedly. We see here that he resides in multiple places. So after completing his original bait-and-switch campaign, baiting with peace and switching to all-out war that gains him control of his empire, he eventually goes upscale. In other words, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. Where his original headquarters is, and where he originally comes from before that, we still don't know for sure. But the progression so far goes something like this. He gets famous from wherever he's originally from for his work on the League, and he then lands by his expertise in flattery and his talent to work deceitfully with enough control over a small European country to exploit this power to take over most of Europe, after which he makes himself welcome in the richest places of the kingdom, probably places like Versailles or Buckingham Palace, and some other of the fattest places in Europe. I mean, I'm assuming he will be changing camps frequently during the beginning of Sorrows. And again, the idea is that the camps will be more like Camp David than anything the U.S. Forest Service has available. Naturally, having created such a stir in his new kingdom, the Antichrist will stir up his neighbors too. To the south of the Antichrist's new empire, across the Mediterranean Sea, I expect will probably still be what is now Sunni Muslim Egypt. The Muslims there will necessarily be among the nations more than upset by the way the Antichrist is running things in his new empire. And we should see that by the start of the beginning of Sorrows, that Egypt will again be the chief of all the Muslim nations in the Muslim world, as they have been before. This dominance existed as recently as during the Six-Day War against Israel in 1967, when they mustered 100,000 Egyptian troops on the Sinai Peninsula, but were nonetheless handily defeated by Israel. I don't really know the condition of their army today, but it's certainly not now any real threat to Israel. And I doubt it's a very great and mighty army yet. But I do know that in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, they vowed to rebuild their defeated forces. And I know that, at least eventually, they will, because I see Gabriel telling us in verse 25 that the king of the south, plainly still in Egypt, will again have a very great and mighty army, which will contend with the Antichrist's lesser, but nonetheless great army, in that day. This, by the way, is one of the ways Scripture shows us that the rapture of the church, or the start of the Great Tribulation, is not likely to happen anytime real soon. Evidently, Egypt needs more time to fit this description again. And there are still other reasons from Scripture that the Great Tribulation is not imminent that we will get to further on. Still, most of the indicators seem to be already in place, many of which we will also continue to establish along the way. But I find it ironic that the coming of the time of the end makes it possible for us to see that time cannot be quite up yet. Verses 25 through 28 describe the first of three major conflicts between the Antichrist, king of the north, and this future Egyptian, king of the south, in the beginning of Sorrows. These wars involving the Antichrist are allegorized in the first seal judgment by John. In this opening judgment, we see the rider on a white horse, who had a bow and who had a crown given unto him, and who went forth conquering and to conquer. Revelation 6:2. This summary of the Antichrist and his wars in the beginning of Sorrows must include his original Catholic Revolutionary War to take over his kingdom, and the three conflicts with Egypt too. But the only successful conquering he accomplishes early on applies to his own kingdom, at least until the end of the beginning of Sorrows. This is because we will see that in the first conflict with Egypt, that though they are all stirred up, and though the Antichrist nonetheless makes some gains, these two kingdoms don't really come to blows. And we'll see that he is backed down from a fight by the participating superpowers in the second Egyptian conflict. But he does ultimately conquer Egypt by the end of the beginning of Sorrows, and many others beyond the midpoint of the Great Tribulation. In verse 25, Gabriel tells us that the Antichrist seems to be the one with the better courage and forecast to get in the first strike against the Egyptians. This apparently includes the best intelligence espionage and strategic planning. And apparently, since he's the guy with the smaller army, instead of directly attacking them, his first plans involved dividing and weakening Egypt without really having to fight them. So this future, originally very great and mighty army of Egypt's will in the whole process be twice whipped by the Antichrist's comparatively merely great army, but not conquered until the last of these three confrontations. In the first confrontation, the Antichrist definitely shall stir up his great army, and the King of the South will plainly be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, too. But this Egyptian king will not get the chance to engage, because they, the Antichrist and his Egyptian insider conspirator, shall forecast devices, plots, or schemes against him. Here they must be the Antichrist and his conspiring on the inside Egyptian usurper, and him must be the sitting Egyptian king of the south. The conspiratorial devices would apparently involve some kind of Antichrist-supported Egyptian coup d'etat. This is further suggested in verse 26, which adds to the description of this war that is indeed ultimately won by espionage, that the Antichrist exploits an insider to destroy the Egyptian king from within, while in the process causing many Egyptians to fall down slain. The picture given is that the Egyptian army seems to overflow on itself. So this first Egyptian war may be better described as a civil war in Egypt that the Antichrist instigates and orchestrates. He simply gets the Egyptians to fight among themselves. He only feigns war with them as a distraction to the sitting king so a usurper can catch him off guard. This civil war could easily be a Shia versus Sunni Muslim thing that the Antichrist simply takes advantage of. But more likely, the Antichrist just plays on the jealousy of a general or an official and or relative of the Egyptian king by offering support for the overthrow. And this will be a successful plan, where again, the victors are seen to divide the spoils. Verse 26 also suggests that the Antichrist may have, in advance, a connection into the highest circles of the Egyptian government, that he may have an existing relationship with someone who is close enough to the King of the South to eat at his table, or feed of the portion of his meat. Did he establish this connection working on the League? Or maybe he grew up in an intersecting circle of Muslims? Whatever the case, at first glance this appears to be an unlikely connection, unless all this implies that the Antichrist is that unique character that is accepted in both European Catholic and in at least some high Muslim circles. He at least seems to be accepted as an ally of sorts in a certain top circle of the Egyptian government early in his empire. So we'll have to keep our eye on this possibility as we go. And this point, compartmentalized by itself, might lead you to think that the Antichrist's kingdom must be in Southwest Asia. But Gabriel has already oriented us to the Antichrist's apparently European geopolitical outlook. And we'll see more of this same perspective later on. But the ultimate proof that the Antichrist operates originally from Europe is the ineligibility of Southwest Asia and the U.S. to host his kingdom due to their clear involvements in other capacities, or incapacities, as the case may be. In any event, the final result of this conspiratorial first conflict with Egypt, besides that many Egyptians fall down slain in a surprise attack from the rear by their own countrymen, is that this insider conspirator and the Antichrist will finally openly negotiate and divide the spoils of Egypt. In verse 27, the final resolution of the first Egyptian war is seen at the bargaining table, where both these kings' hearts, the Antichrists and the new usurping Egyptians, shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Here we are informed that the new king of the south and the Antichrist come to an agreement that neither of them intends to keep. It's also clear here that this is not yet the end of the conflict, and that it's not really even started, but that it's being forecast as they speak lies at one table, read negotiate, and that it will undoubtedly come at the time appointed. So the outcome of this first round of mischief and lies are plainly just the first step in the Antichrist's plan to divide and weaken Egypt so that in the next war he can conquer them. Still, there are other encouragements for the Antichrist's participation in this Egyptian civil war that he will take home with him, but also some disappointments that will also come sailing his way that will blockade his next attempt to attack Egypt, as we will see. Verse 28 further clarifies that it must have been a planned conspiracy against the first king of the south to unseat him. This is seen in the post-war showcasing of the Antichrist's bargaining prowess following the conflict. The Antichrist is shown here to take home a big chunk of change for his troubles, to return to his own land with great riches. It's also shown to be when his mischief and lies really get going against the Jews in Israel, and probably against Protestants worldwide too. We can tell this because his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and the center of this Holy Covenant would be in Israel. Now the Holy Covenant in question here must be the covenant between God and his people, the Jews. And being against such a holy covenant must be referring to the Antichrist's actions that he takes because of his hatred of the Jews. I also expect this hostility must be supported by his politically and economically motivated religious affiliation, which will also dictate his both internal and international contempt for Muslims. And this contempt for Muslims, besides their being generally uncooperative, is mostly because they are in the way between him and the Jews. And the ultimate expression of the Antichrist's contempt for both Muslims and Jews will not be seen until the Third Egyptian War, near the end of the beginning of Sorrows. This is the war that will finally throw open the door for the overthrow of Israel. But when it comes to the Antichrist's widespread problem with Muslims, God will take care of most of that for him, which the Antichrist will undoubtedly take the credit for. And as for the other exploits of the Antichrist mentioned in verse 28, I have nothing specific to add, except that a few verses later we learn that the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits at this time, too. The next major conflict involving the Antichrist kingdom in the beginning of Sorrows, apparently near the halfway point of the first 3.5 years, probably doesn't significantly involve the Antichrist kingdom at all, but surely involves the new Muslim king of the south. We can see by the earlier negotiations that this new Egyptian king can't wait to get at the Antichrist. But we can also deduce that there must be someone else he wants to get at even more, and that would be Israel. But instead of this new king of the south leading the attack on such a campaign, he finds someone even bigger and stronger to lead this one, and that would be a king in an empire to the far north, presently called Russia. but the King of the South will also get help from a lot of his neighbors, too. These neighbors will surely include Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Libya, assuming all these remain separate countries. And these may even get the help of still other North African or Southwest Asian Muslim countries. This horde of Muslim countries will inevitably join in an attack coordinated by Russia on Israel. And of course, it will be a wipeout, because God will be doing all the fighting. The now more sure word of prophecy makes clear that no coalition of nations will have a chance against Israel in the beginning of sorrows. But again, it also makes clear that Israel will fall to the Antichrist at the midpoint. We will also confirm that this mid-beginning of sorrows wipeout of the Russians and Muslims in Southwest Asia is probably the best reason why the Antichrist kingdom cannot be established anywhere in this region. But for now, suffice it to say that this Russian and Muslim earth-shaking war against Israel must be a major factor in the Antichrist's ultimate success in his third war with the King of the South. Russia, Egypt, and the rest of the Muslim world will necessarily be significantly weakened as a result of joining this attack on Israel. And the Antichrist will undoubtedly try to take advantage of and credit for this unimaginably awesome defense of Israel by God. But the full confirmation of this wipeout won't be completed until section 9. In verse 29, we find Gabriel's comparison of the three campaigns of the Antichrist against Egypt, where he explains how the middle campaign is different from the first and last. This also proves that there are three of them altogether. And without this verse, we might assume otherwise, and we would not know that verse 30 is about this different middle campaign that somehow shall not be as the former or as the latter. And in verse 30, we should expect to see how it's different, too. By the way, we are also seeing as we go, as surmised earlier, that this still all appears to be the same King of the North, since verse 21. The obviousness of this again seen in the fact that all three of these campaigns must be carried out by the same King of the North, namely the Antichrist. And I think this observation alone is sufficient enough to prove the case that there is only one King of the North in verses 21 to 45, though we have already confirmed two different kings of Egypt so far. In verse 30, we see why the Antichrist's middle campaign is different. This would be because the Antichrist loses this one. And this would be because Egypt, and I expect anyone else in the region who needs it, will have different help in this second war with the Antichrist kingdom. And this different help will successfully frustrate the Antichrist to the end that, therefore shall he be grieved and return home. Who will grieve the Antichrist and send him home? And how? Verse 30 tells us it's because the ships of Chittim shall come against him. If the Muslim world and Russians are already crippled by God in their attack on Israel by this time, and they probably are, the remainder of the world, except the Catholics, will be understandably concerned about the Antichrist's aspirations given these new opportunities. Verses 29 and 30 show that when the time appointed appears to have come for the Antichrist to again return and attack a newly vulnerable Egypt, it's instead the time when his new empire is confronted by the ships of Chittim. The Eastern Bible Dictionary definition of Chittim is as follows. Chittim, or Chittim, a plural form, Genesis 10:4, the name of a branch of the descendants of Javan, the son of Japheth, son of Noah. Balaam foretold, Numbers 24:24, that ships shall come from the coast of Chittim and afflict Eber. Daniel prophesied, Daniel 11:30, that the ships of Chittim would come against the king of the north. It probably denotes Cyprus, whose ancient capital was called Kidion by the Greeks. The references elsewhere made to Chittim, Isaiah 23:1-12, Jeremiah 2:10, and Ezekiel 27:6, are to be explained on the grounds that while the name originated with the Phoenicians only, it came latterly to be used of all the islands and various settlements on the seacoasts which they had occupied, and then of the people who succeeded them when the Phoenician power decayed. Hence, it designates generally the islands and coasts of the Mediterranean and the races that inhabit them. And it's this last designation in this definition that Chittim refers to the successors of Phoenician naval power, and to generally the islands and coasts of the Mediterranean, that makes the most sense in verse 30. And what better term is available to Gabriel if he wants to allude to the great naval powers in existence at this future time, no matter where they came from? Tarshish, or Tharshish, the brother of Kittim, has become a term that is nearly synonymous, also defined by Eaton. It appears that the name Tarshish also is, as Chittim, used without reference to any locality. Ships of Tarshish is an expression sometimes denoting simply ships intended for a long voyage, Isaiah 23:14. Ships of a large size, seagoing ships, whatever might be the port to which they sailed. Solomon's ships were so styled, 1 Kings 10:22 and 22:49. So evidently, Gabriel did not choose ships of Tarshish here, because they are, though large and possibly warships too, more commonly identified as merchant cargo ships traveling on long voyages, often beyond the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea. Whereas the ships of Chittim are also big, but more characteristically hanging out in the Mediterranean, and apparently more likely warships than merchant ships. Having said that, I don't see the distinction between them as being very significant. Gabriel may have tossed a coin on this one. They seem more or less interchangeable to me. Still, I gather that if you wanted to emphasize that a ship was in the process of traveling a long way, or was a merchant ship, you would more likely think Tarshish, originally located at the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea. But if you wanted to emphasize that its operation was focused in the Mediterranean, or that it was a warship, you would think Chittim. Of course, the ships, in verse 30, would logically be best placed in the Mediterranean to discourage this upcoming confrontation between Europe and newly vulnerable Egypt. And I think that whoever was still able to float the biggest boats, and think they could get away with floating them in the Mediterranean Sea in the beginning of sorrows, and whoever might be inclined to try to do so in order to keep the peace, and who could and would threaten a preemptive strike in a situation deemed out of control between Europe and the Muslim world, and whoever could and would make the Antichrist return home with his tail between his legs, grieved, they must be the owners of these particular ships of Chittim. So who could they be? The biggest boat floaters, besides the major European countries already controlled by the Antichrist, would be China, Russia, and the United States. Since we'll clearly see China's involvement coming late in the Days of Vengeance, and in a completely different way, I see their participation at this time less likely. Besides, they would be more inclined to let Europe and the Muslims fight it out so that they could come mop up afterward. I also expect that early in the beginning of sorrows, that China, just like the Antichrist kingdom in Russia, will be fully occupied with consolidating power in her own region. In China's case, this would involve expansion from North Korea to Australia and out into the Pacific. But somewhere in this process, China should also expect that there will be someone else who will stand in her way. And I expect it will be the same someone who obstructs the Antichrist in his first attempt at mopping up the vulnerable Muslims. This kind of obstruction must be from the United States. And I'm expecting that, like in World War II, the U.S. will be stretched between both hemispheres dealing with all these conflicts. I mean, unless the U.S. beforehand withdraws their troops from the Asian Pacific theater, they must somehow be engaged with China early on. And apparently this kind of worldwide conflict is promised in the Fourth Seal Judgment, possibly also implying that the U.S.-China conflict may reach the U.S. mainland early on, or it may take place mostly in the Eastern Pacific, or both. But evidently, all this conflict remains mostly outside God's focus of attention around Israel, as we will continue to confirm. I also expect it's China who will be attracting the Antichrist's attention early in the days of vengeance, but again, only in theaters far removed from Israel. And all this is why I doubt they will provide any of the ships of Chittim described in verse 30. I expect instead that, in the beginning of sorrows, China's ships will be busy about their already expressed intentions to expand control of her own region, the U.S. likely withstanding. And again, the reason deduction should be expected to play such a big part in interpretation when it comes to China and the U.S. is that God's attention is always centered on Israel. We will continue to deduce that some contenders to world power in the Great Tribulation get very little or no mention in prophecy, except at times when directly involved with Israel, or at least with the Antichrist kingdom. But by the process of elimination, we can deduce the peripheral activities of all the major players, even from an Israeli-focused perspective. Specifically, that the U.S. and China must at least be somewhat occupied with each other early on, and nowhere near Israel. And notice that this perspective is also seen in the way God defines all of the seven world-ruling kingdoms. Israel and what's going on around her is always the focus of God's designs. It's the God zone. So China does not likely move into the picture in the beginning of sorrows. But I think that the U.S., and possibly some others, will reach the God zone in the beginning of sorrows, as we will see. As for Russia, it may be more likely, but not expected, that she will provide some of these ships of Chittim. The reason being that I expect Russia's ground forces will be seriously depleted by this time because of her attack on Israel. But it could be that she may still have a navy that is able to play a role in the events described in verse 30. Still, we should also remember that a third part of the ships of the sea by this time may also be destroyed due to the second trumpet judgment, Revelation 8:9. But maybe not yet. Surely, though, countries that have had a history of having trouble feeding themselves, like Russia, will be having more than ever before, early in the beginning of sorrows, having already suffered through the famines and pandemics caused by the first four seal judgments. And by the sixth seal judgment, such like countries must certainly be looking for spoil, Ezekiel 38:13, just to feed themselves. And Russia, at the time of their attack on Israel, must instead become that spoil for Israel, Ezekiel 39:10, as we will prove in due course. So in verse 30, at the time of the Second Egyptian War. We are likely somewhere just over halfway through the beginning of sorrows, and likely past the seal judgments anyway. And possibly even past the ship-sinking second trumpet judgment, too. So at this point, God will have likely already targeted and crushed the Russians along with the rest of the Muslim world because of their transgression of targeting Israel for spoil. Still, it could also be this attack on Israel that will bring Russian ships into the Mediterranean. But if most of their army is already destroyed by God, I'm guessing that their navy won't be doing so good either. And all this is likely the case, or the Antichrist would not yet see his way clear to attempt a mop-up of the Muslim world. It must be this devastation of the Russians and Muslims by God that tempts the Antichrist to wage his second Egyptian war. And he would probably get away with it at this time, except that the U.S., as they are known to do, must still be able to get in his way in time with their ships of Chittim and turn him around and send him back home. Again, it's the U.S. that is most likely to be inclined to use their ships in this way. They have been the world's policemen, maintaining world stability for the last century or more, and would likely come to the defense of the Muslim world again for this reason. Of course, they may suffer the loss of a third of their navy by this time, too. Possibly more than a third, because they will probably have more boats afloat in the sea to lose. Not to mention that they are likely already quarreling with China and others. But remember that God is doing the targeting in all these judgments. So the U.S. may suffer fewer losses if God is not targeting her ships, and if he has a purpose for her ships to fulfill. My guess is that this last scenario is more likely, because I expect God has prepared and is still preparing the U.S. for this assignment, to back down the Antichrist in the middle of the beginning of sorrows. So the Antichrist will be forced to change his mind when unnamed new forces sail into the picture. He will bring out his armies to attack Egypt, but the show of force of the ships of Chittim will cause him to return home grieved. And if not likely China or Russia, then who besides the U.S. could float such ships in the Mediterranean? And who could and would stand up to the united forces of Europe and be willing and able to force the Antichrist to back down by this kind of show of force? There will certainly be no more NATO at this time. But I'm rooting for Great Britain, too. Yes, I know they're somewhat associated with the EU now, but I have reason to believe she will evade the Antichrist kingdom, at least early on, and participate in this blockade. We'll get to those reasons more in the next section when we rehash and expand these deductions. For now, it appears that the U.S. will be the best qualified, most inclined, and still able to make the Antichrist back down with a bunch of big boats, and is still likely to still have the right stuff to do it with, too. The Antichrist's grieved condition because of being backed down forces him to redirect his attention to an evidently more covert conspiracy against Israel. And this is a horrifying revelation. We learn at the end of verse 30 that when the Antichrist shall return home, he will have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, Gabriel is not likely speaking so much here about worldwide antisemitism. He must instead be speaking of how the Antichrist will infiltrate groups and organizations within Israel, conspiring to use one faction against another inside the Holy Land. In this case, he will somehow enlist the help of Israelites who will voluntarily forsake the Holy Covenant and use them to try to defeat the people that do know their God. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that there will be those in Israel who will be tired of being the bad guys and will naturally scapegoat the covenant keepers as the source of all the problems for Israel, and will naturally accept the help of anyone who could help them rid Israel of these nuisances while restoring the hope of peace. These kinds of sentiments will make the Antichrist their man. But until I understood this verse, it really never occurred to me that these same covenant-forsaking Israelites are they who Jesus is also plainly describing on the Mount of Olives. Go ahead, read Matthew 24:9-14, Mark 13:9-13, and Luke 21:12-19. And recognize these Israelite turncoats for who they really are. Surely they are the ones whom the Antichrist will stoke up with the indignation against the Holy Covenant in Israel. And we can now understand, as the Antichrist apparently will, that this will be the only way to defeat Israel, to turn Israel against herself. And though Jesus is more general on the timing of this behavior in his account, Gabriel specifically indicates that with the Antichrist's help, this fiendish campaign in Israel will gain steam in the second half of the beginning of sorrows, just after the preempted Second Egyptian War. And all this will be more fully developed as we go.